This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Paul Cox, is in New York for a retrospective of his films at Lincoln Center. Cox is a Dutch-born director who has lived and worked in Australia since 1963. His work is about as far as you can get from the Australian film industry's best-known export, Crocodile Dundee. He makes low-budget, idiosyncratic films, such as the offbeat comedies Man of Flowers and Lonely Hearts. His film Vincent, about Vincent van Gogh, was described by film critic Andrew Saras as the most profound exploration of an artist's soul ever to be put on film. Cox's new film, A Woman's Tale, is about an independent, spirited woman nearing 80 who has cancer. Her son thinks she should be moved to a nursing home, but she insists on living in her own apartment. Cox wrote the movie for the Australian actress Sheila Florence, who he had known for 25 years. For her work in A Woman's Tale, Florence won the Best Actress Award from the Australian Film Institute. She accepted the award in her hospital bed 9 days before her death. Here's a scene from A Woman's Tale in which the old woman is telling her young nurse, who is also her best friend, about a funeral from which she just returned.
They left the lid off the coffin at the service yesterday. It's astonishing to see how beautiful people are in death. Beauty in life may come from makeup or clothing or whatever, but for beauty in death, you have to fall back on character.
So your friend didn't disappoint you?
He wasn't my friend. He was my husband's friend. I didn't even like him much in life. But in death, he was fine. When I'm not sure about a person, I picture them dead. That always gives them away.
Now, you wrote the story for the actress Sheila Florence. She had cancer when you wrote this movie. Did you know that she was dying?
Oh, yes, we were fully aware of that. It was a race against time and against death, so to speak. But I think in the process we made very much a film about life. I always promised that she would become a star one day. As a joke, we had this long-standing joke, turn me into a star, as she used to say. And then when I heard she was dying, I went to see her and I said, Sheila, it's about time. Well, let's go and make you into a star. It was a very... And she gave her last drop to this film. It was an extraordinary experience for anyone involved. We all were deeply affected by her.
How did she feel about playing someone who was dying of cancer like she was?
Well, she said, it's the same like when you, at a certain stage in your life, you must say to yourself and to the world, there's no more time for rubbish. I must now be, you know, there's no more time for lies or compromises. This is what I am. This is what I want to be. And for her, there was no more time for anything but being herself. And also, as she said, that at the end of her life, she could feel her heart was filling with such love that she needed to find a vehicle to express it in. It was very strange. As we made this film, she was oozing with love. It was a remarkable thing to watch. I've never, ever in my whole life seen somebody blossoming like that at the edge of death, you know. So, I don't know. It was an absolutely extraordinary experience. And when she died, although we expected that all the time, but there was such an incredible, immense sense of loss came over me that I still find it hard to even, you know, talk about it now. And this is already 6-7 months ago.
I guess you became very close through the making of the movie.
Yeah, and we were already good friends, you know. We had a marvelous sort of funny relationship that was slightly cynical at times. And even making the film, we had fights. But then she would say at the end of the day, I'll do anything for you. So I said, what about a nude scene as a joke? And so she hopped in the bath and did this nude scene, which people have really been very, some people have been very worried about, this old woman naked in the bath. But my God, it's a very beautiful scene. And some people said, oh, it's very offensive. Well, I find anybody that pulls a gun on the big screen, I find that very offensive, you know.
Yeah, the scene is she's in the tub, and she's kind of having something between a dream and a flashback. You see her naked from the waterline of the tub up, so you see her naked chest. She wasn't uncomfortable with that, was she?
Not at all, no.
I think there's this taboo again, seeing older people's bodies.
Well, it's very strange that we live in a society that can only somehow recognize the surface and celebrate the exterior and never give the interior any thought. That's quite puzzling to me. It has always been very puzzling.
Were there times you had to stop shooting the movie because of Sheila Florence's health?
Yeah, we had the standard line. I used to say to her, "Don't die on me, because you'll kill me." Because we couldn't, we couldn't really insure the whole thing. But there's a scene in the bath when she does this scene in the sea bath. It was very hot, salt water, and even some elderly extras fainted. So I didn't realize it at the time. It was very silly of me. And when she came out, she was very weak and feeble, and I thought, that's it, you know. But the film at the end gave her life. She lived for another 6 months, and she was given 8 weeks before we started. We lost 2 weeks, so we had 6 weeks left to shoot the film.
Wow, so you were really racing against the clock.
Absolutely. But then it gave her so much lust for life that she she went back into her flat and organized dinner parties. It was extraordinary. She was alive.
You've said in an interview that I read with you that the way the Sheila Florence character talks in the movie is like how people talk in Ingmar Bergman films, but Bergman wouldn't have been as celebrated if he were making movies in English, because it wouldn't work in the English language. If you say in English, "I'm full of fear" or "I'm full of pain," people fall out of their seat laughing. And I'm wondering if you speak from experience with that.
Absolutely. I think the English audience is very cynical. You cannot really talk about feelings. You have to hide them, even hide them within the story, because if you were to express what your heart tells you, everybody would fall out of their seats. People are very, very cynical. But Bergman never did this. That's what I tried to say there, because, and I thought he was very lucky to be able to say it in Swedish and have subtitles explaining it. If it had been in English, especially at that time, people wouldn't have taken it to it so much. It was a nice way of disguising the whole thing, you know.
So, have you ever written something that, you know, an actor or actress has said in one of your movies that was really heartfelt, but you found audiences couldn't handle it, that they laughed?
Oh, yeah. All my earlier films, that's why I've hidden them.
what kind of lines would get that kind of response?
Oh, anything. You name it, it was there. And they were very heavy. And usually I used amateurs because I couldn't afford to pay professionals. But I learned from the experience. And most of those films, they were either burned or put on the shelves, and I'm hiding them. They wanted to very much show to me in New York, but I couldn't do that to these films and to the people that were in it. We laugh at them now and then, and they taught me a lot. So I don't want really, I don't want to bring them back to an audience. It would really be pure comedy now.
Well, you've been making movies in Australia for as long as you've been making movies. What was the state of the Australian film industry when you started?
Well, at that point, it didn't really exist. Then suddenly, there were some films being made, like Picnic at Hanging Rock and all that. That was
in the 70s.
Yeah, and I was making shorts and all sorts of little things and experimental movies at the time. But I never had any desire to really make feature films. I didn't want to be a filmmaker. I didn't have any aspirations on that level.
So why did you become a filmmaker if you didn't want to be one?
Because life is not a matter of choice. Life is very much fate, I think. And the more you believe in fate, the more choice you seem to have in the end. But I had no choice in the end after I made one film that really got me and haunted me and didn't let me sleep that I decided to become a filmmaker. I also was teaching at an art school. I was teaching photography, graphics, painting, and various things. And they were suddenly given a grant to open up a cinematography department. So if that hadn't happened, I would never have continued. I still say now that if you want to do anything really seriously, it must be a hobby. If you do it as a profession, a certain degree of compromise sets in, and you always seem to have to sell out certain ideas and things. So still, all this, my full life now, I still treat my filmmaking as some gigantic mad hobby, you know.
Mm. If you're just joining us, my guest is Paul Cox. He's Dutch, but he's lived in Australia since the 1960s. And there's a retrospective of his films that's being shown now in New York. And it's also the theatrical premiere of his latest film, A Woman's Tale. We're going to take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Paul Cox, and his movies include Man of Flowers, Lonely Hearts, and his latest film, A Woman's Tale, which has just had its theatrical debut in the United States. It's part of a retrospective of his films that's showing now in New York. Now, you're Dutch. You came to Australia at the age, I think, of 23 in probably around 1963. Why did you stay? You came as an exchange student.
Yeah, I just went to Melbourne Uni for a while, and then I could go back and make... I did go back. I spent a year travelling through the Pacific, and I was still growing up. I was a very slow developer, so to speak. I was very shy and backwards, and I was a bit of a moronic character going into the world, and I had no idea what was going on. I think it took me 18 years to find out where babies came from, so I came from the Middle Ages, more or less.
Yeah. Why did it take you so long to find out about
this?
Well,
it was just my whole upbringing was... I had to escape that. I knew I was being choked by my upbringing, so I escaped my father's influence by going as far as I possibly could. And also, because I got a scholarship, at least I could get away. But then, when I was... The first 6 months in Australia, I hated very much. There was no village square. I hardly spoke the language. I just felt totally alienated. Then I went back and... spend a lot of time traveling. And also, just before I left, I'd met somebody I'd fallen in love with in the most insane, mad way, because I've been so isolated for so long that you lose the sense of reality. So I was quite a dangerous lunatic at the time. And so for that very reason, I went back to Australia to go back as a migrant. And of course, that was all quite crazy, but then I had to stay for 2 years, and that's more or less I got hooked. After the 2 years, I went to live in India and Indonesia, and I think that's when I really did my growing up in a different culture altogether.
Now, you refer to your father as being very conservative, culturally conservative. I assume that from what you were saying.
Not only that, but totally embittered after the war. He had a film company, and his father had a few magazines and stuff. They were quite well off, and... he had made a few feature films. And after the war, everything, because my grandfather was born in Germany, the whole family fortune and everything that came with it was basically destroyed or taken away. So my father had to start again, and he never recovered. He became very bitter about life and cynical. So my childhood was steeped in deep misery, I would say. I had a very loving mother, and I always... So he sort of protected me against all this, overprotected me, of course, but I always say I owe all my humanity to her. So he had, despite the things he went through, so he never had one bad word for another human being. A whole life, I never would have heard her say anything wrong about anybody else. There was an extraordinary loving person there, and in one way she overprotected me. She also gave me great hope that we never must lose faith in the individual. So I'm an incredibly... in debt to my mother.
Did your father take out his bitterness and frustration on you?
Oh, yes. I was a rather peculiar child. And it's only... he was... he's now in a home. He's still alive. But I went to the old family home and found a few letters from before the war where he was really a great poet and writer and so many things that had a horizon. And it was suddenly closed after the war. When you look at all the documentation, it's quite chattering, so I don't blame him for what happened. But it was also, you know, I felt very suppressed within this sort of situation. And there's a letter from a psychiatrist they sent me to, because I must have been a rather peculiar child. And the psychiatrist said they couldn't expect too much from me. He was a really strange little boy, and the best they could hope for is to find something to do with his hands. That was very funny to find this, and it kept this letter from this expert to talk about my future. And no wonder my father treated me with a certain degree of suspicion.
Huh. Now, so your father was a filmmaker. Mm. Did that interest you in movies?
No, but it was... Yes, he had... He talked about the films he did, but we never saw them. He was so bitter that he wouldn't even take them out of the safes. They were all over the place, and... I used to go up on the attic, and there was a lot of old movie equipment there, old winders and reels and bits of film, and I was fascinated by this, and I could sit there for hours, just look at it and, you know, play with it a little. It had an impact on me, the mystery of this. The mystery of film is still puzzling me now, but there was something very mysterious about the equipment and the bits of film and the pictures and whatever came with it. And that was sort of left in all this rubbish up in the attic.
So you were able to play around with, what, projectors, cameras?
In great secret. I said I was not allowed to touch anything, of course, but I used to sneak in there, and just somehow it fascinated me. There was some other world there. There was some other mystery I had to discover, I had to go into.
In I guess it was in 1984 or 83, you worked with the German director Werner Herzog, who's a brilliant but very eccentric filmmaker, and he was making a movie in Australia called Where the Green Ants Dream. What did you do with him on that film?
Well, Werner and I were long-standing friends before that.
Oh, from what? And,
well, he saw a few films of mine, very early shorts in Germany, and when we met, we really hit it off, and he lived with me for a while, and we sort of traveled and walked together. And before then, after Fitzgerald, he was quite broken, things went wrong, and he stayed with me for quite some time. So we were very good friends before all this happened. And also in Man of Flowers, when he basically plays my father. Man of Flowers is fairly autobiographical. It's only coming out in the last few years. It's much more autobiographical than My First Wife, where he plays my father in the flashbacks. If you ever see it, it's quite an enormous, marvelous performance. And then his brother told me that he behaved exactly like his own father. So we had very similar fathers. You see what they can do to their sons? Anyway, on the Green Ants, I just helped him with finding the locations, and then with anything what came along, I took stills and even acted in it.
I have to stop you here and ask you about how autobiographical Man of Flowers is. The man in Man of Flowers is someone who likes to have a woman come and strip, and it's very arousing to him, but what he does with that energy of arousal is play this kind of wild and passionate piano music. Mm. So what aspect of that is autobiographical?
Well, the flashbacks are things that happened to me. And if I hadn't, for instance, gone away and started a whole different life and had been confronted by an extraordinary exotic sort of thing like in the East, away from that heavy European influence, where if I had stayed at home, I would have become the Charles Bremmer from A Man of Flowers, I'm sure.
Someone who lives this incredibly insular life.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I escaped that in time. I knew that would be happening. I would die. It would choke me if I had stayed. I knew I had to move, change my life. It was a matter of life or death. If I hadn't gone, I would be dead now. I'm absolutely sure. But the flashbacks that caused this are very much, all of them really happened to me when I was a kid, you know, the incredible fascination with the bosom and the you know, whatever the father does to the son, that really happened to me physically.
And what was it?
Well, he almost tears the ear off a boy's head. Once the boy shoots through a window with a catapult, and the father runs after him and almost kills him. There are many things that are very close to whatever happened to me.
Do you talk much with your father now?
He's very old and gray and full of tears and sad, and it's sad to watch it. I've forgiven everything. It's hard to forget.
Have your parents seen your movies?
It's funny that you ask me this. I think my father had seen a few on television, usually fell asleep. And I very much now, with the retrospective, I find this quite moving. I know my mother would have been terribly proud. I wish she were alive, and I would have taken her to New York. And, you know, for her sake, I would have enjoyed this whole thing. So it's a pity. She saw some earlier movies of mine, and then there was such, some 15 years ago or something, my father walked into a barber shop and had his hair done and found a magazine, and there was a story on me in it, and he took it home and he hid it from everybody. This was a Dutch man, I didn't know, but he hid it because he was very angry, and we never found out why.
Was it something you'd said about him in the interview?
No, nothing to do with it. It's just, I think he became straight away already very jealous that I had succeeded, or whatever that is. Success is all nonsense to him, and I think it was something he had always wanted to do, and it didn't happen. So he was a very peculiar man. I love him now, and I find him very sad, and it's just too late.
What does it mean to you to have a retrospective in New York now?
Well, as I said, I would like my mother to be here and to see that. I think I was very lucky that I never had any success until I was 40 or so. So Van Gogh always said that the worst thing that can happen to an artist is to have success, because as soon as you, and then you're too young and it goes to your head, you've had it. You don't really progress or travel anywhere anymore. But on that respect, as far as my so-called ego is concerned, it doesn't do very much for me. In fact, it hurts me a little that it's taken so long for certain films to be appreciated. On the other hand, I'm grateful and I'm moved. I'm moved by it. It just moves me.
You mentioned Vincent van Gogh. You just quoted him, and one of your movies, Vincent, is based on the letters Vincent van Gogh wrote to his brother Theo. Mm. Why did you want to make a movie about him?
Well, there's very few people in the whole history of the arts. Vincent is a perfect example of the so-called creative process. His paintings and his writings travel very closely together, so it gives you an enormous insight in the actual creative process in the artist's mind. And then his writings actually are so... There's very few people that manage to put down on paper what they feel. Mm-hmm. That's always an expression of thought, and thought is a conditioned thing. It's part of your conditioning. So most people say the wrong thing in the right way. Vincent spoke his heart, and that always fascinated me, and I loved his letters and, of course, his paintings. And I thought one day I must make a film using these letters, let him speak for himself and just travel the way his mind traveled and everything. And, of course, there was another film that was very difficult to make because it took me a long time and nobody wanted to know. And it became very successful. It's been a very successful movie. I'm now doing a similar thing on the dancer Nijinsky, because also he was also a character that could express, in his diary, he expresses what he felt. And it's, again, a unique thing. They both said that their so-called madness was their love for mankind. And, you know, if that has to drive you mad, and mankind really should investigate what... what is going on. They both talked about this white light. I still don't know exactly what that white light is, but they had glimpses of illuminations. You know, they were both... they would perceive something well beyond our horizon. And it fascinates me. I think they're both amazing characters.
Did you ever wonder about yourself whether certain things you were feeling were wonderful passion or real madness?
Oh, I have been very worried about my sanity at times. Truly have had, great doubts, and I've had my own sort of healths to live with and breakdowns and stuff, but I'm doing much better now.
Paul Cox, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Paul Cox's new film is A Woman's Tale. A retrospective of his work is being shown in New York at Lincoln Center. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.